Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me start by introducing today's panellists. Sherry Goodman, who you no doubt recognise, served as Deputy Undersecretary for Defence for Environmental Strategy in the US Department of Defence between 1993 and 2001. From 2001 to 2015, she was Senior Vice President of CNA, a not-for-profit organisation focused on national security. At CNA, she founded and served as Executive Director of the CNA Military Advisory Board, a leading voice on the national security threats of climate change. Ian Dunlop is a Cambridge-educated engineer who worked as a senior oil, gas and coal industry executive. He chaired the Australian Coal Association and the Australian Greenhouse Office Experts Group on Emissions Trading, served as CEO of the Institute of Company Directors and is a member of the Club of Rome. Alan DuPont, and I'm sorry I got these in the wrong order, as you'll find out in a moment, Alan DuPont is founder and CEO of the Cognoscenti Group, a political and strategic risk consultancy, and is a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. He spent 25 years in government as an army officer, defence intelligence analyst, and a diplomat. He later held senior appointments at UNSW and the University of Sydney, and is a contributing national security editor for The Australian. Sherry, I'd like to start with you. The film, even in its abridged version, is extremely compelling. And I'm sure I'm not alone in wanting to know how it came about. So can you tell us, how did the film come to be made? What's the background that you can tell us, and what are you hoping that it will achieve?
Well, thank you very much, Louisa. And let me say it's a pleasure to be here with all of you down under. I've been on this journey, as you can see, for the film for quite some time. I joined the U.S. Department of Defense in 1993 at a time when there was a great deal of skepticism that there was even connection between the general subject of environment. We weren't even talking about climate change in those days, but just environment and the military. The most basic connection was just cleaning up old military bases that had become Superfund sites, or protecting water or air pollution and risks at U.S. bases affecting U.S. forces either at home or as they deployed overseas. But during that period, 8 years that I served in the Department of Defense, we became more aware that there were also global strategic connections between environment and security, and that we needed better to understand how natural forces were affecting the security environment, and also how military actions and military conduct and operations were also adversely affecting the environment. About the 2006 time frame, a group of foundations and others approached me and said, we want better to understand the national security implications of climate change, and we'd like to change the conversation in the U.S., which had already become very polarized about climate change, and would you take this on? And so I organized a group of leading generals and admirals in the U.S., almost all of whom I had worked with personally when I was in the Department of Defense. General Sullivan, whom you saw in the film, was the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. General Zinni was commander of the Central Command. He had commanded our forces during the Gulf War. Admiral Titley, you saw in the film, he was the Navy's oceanographer. Former PACOM commander, Admiral Preer, and many others, former head of the nuclear Navy, Admiral Skip Bowman. And we spent about a year looking at the science and the security implications of climate change. We met with leading climate scientists in the United States and in the UK, which at that time had a more developed advanced research on the intersection of climate change and national security. We learned from them, and then we began to examine the impact on the stability of various regions and on military operations. And what you heard in the film, and what you and is also in our first report issued in 2006, was the voice of that military experience expressing the concern that indeed they recognize that climate change has been a complex underlying root cause of instability, and is further aggravating as a threat multiplier, we characterize it, for instability in fragile regions of the world. And we've been conducting that conversation for a decade now. This is actually 10 years since the first report was issued. And we've held many hearings. You saw some of the testimony in the film, spoken to many groups in the United States and abroad and overseas as well. And the filmmakers, Jared and Sophie, who approached me and some others and said, we want to tell this story in a compelling way through film so we can reach a broad audience. And they began that project. And they literally came to me and they said, we want to follow you around. Where are you speaking? And can we get you on camera? And then they took extensive clips. They did a lot of research. And, you know, this is how they've told the story. They've told it through, you know, myself and the CNA Military Advisory Board. You've also seen some younger officers in there, Mike Breen, who served in recent combat tours, you know, who can speak from experience of having deployed in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and then went on to help refugees. So I think it's a very compelling story. It's one that that's visually arresting the way they've told it, and one that can reach a broader set of audiences.
Sherry, I'm going to stay with you. Defense Secretary Mattis said, climate change is impacting stability in areas of the world where our troops are operating today. It is appropriate for the combatant commands to incorporate drivers of instability that impact the security environment in their areas into their planning. And of course, the film we just watched made it clear that the US military is taking climate change very seriously in their thinking. The US military clearly sees climate change as a contemporary threat multiplier, not a future problem. So I'd like to ask you, how is this calculation affecting military operations now, and how does the US military take climate change into account in its planning?
Well, look, as you saw in the film, it's now widely understood that, you know, the Syrian crisis, the Arab Spring uprisings, all have climate drought, essentially, roots. And the story was well told in the film, that the drought has exacerbated the instability. So how is the military taking this into account? General Mattis understands this very well. He has already asked each of his combatant commanders, commanders in the Pacific, in the Central Command, in Southern Command, which is Latin America, and elsewhere, to account for these factors as they do their regional planning. What does it mean? Drought certainly in the Middle East and in Africa. Changes in the Arctic. I mean, we have a whole new ocean that has opened up because of the rapidly melting ice. We have to deploy forces there in a way that we never had to. And we are unprepared, particularly in the Arctic. We have, at best, 1.5 icebreakers, really 3 aging icebreakers that are mostly used for science, which is very important, but they are not up to the task of being able to perform any critical search and rescue or oil spill prevention mission should there be an incident there. And with the increasing traffic in the opening Arctic today, we are at much greater risk that one of these types of incidents, or worse in the future, could occur. So we have, we've got to accommodate providing capability in that region as well now. So, and we also see, and you saw in the film, military bases are significantly at risk. The Norfolk Hampton Roads Naval Base, which is the greatest constellation of military force probably in the world, and certainly in the U.S. for sure, already experiences what they call sunny day flooding, where people who live in the community literally can't get onto the base because the roads to the base are flooded. And so already the Navy is building, strengthening its piers, raising them up so that they can accommodate this. The community has to get involved and provide new infrastructure. It's a massive sort of resilience planning effort that's underway in that region to adjust that installation, that community, to climate change. Then, because of higher temperatures occurring both in the U.S. and around the world. We're now seeing that our troops have to deploy in higher extremes, in hotter temperatures, and that has significant health risk. We have a health risk condition. We call it a black flag day. And when it's too hot, when it's too long of the day consistently over what we say is 90 degrees Fahrenheit, but you'll translate that to centigrade, it's very hot. Our troops cannot train, and we find an increasing number of black flag days at U.S. military installations, particularly in the South and the Southwest of the United States, where we do a lot of our troop training. And that's also true now when we're deploying forces overseas in the Middle East, where temperatures are increasingly as sustained extreme temperatures.
Alan, I'd like to go to you. Most of the discussion about the security effects of climate change in the film focused on the Middle East, but you've, of course, written extensively for The Australian and elsewhere about security issues in Asia. So let me ask you, what about the Asian security theatre? How is climate change going to affect security in Asia?
Well, I was conscious of that point when I was watching the film, that there wasn't a lot on Asia. So I think the big takeaways for me are that all those impacts are going to be more severely felt in the Asia-Pacific region, probably than most other regions. One, because we have 60% of the world's population in this part of the world. Most of the countries to our north are developing countries. They have less capacity to deal with the consequences of climate change. Food, water, energy concerns are already affecting these countries. So as the film pointed out, that you throw climate change in the mix, it's a trigger event, it's a threat multiplier, it's just another thing that these countries have to deal with. So Asian countries are going to be generally highly impacted. We also, in a part of the world, as we know from Cyclone Debbie just this week in Australia, that a large percentage of the world's cyclones are in this part of the world, and they can be very devastating in their consequences. So if we're going to see more severe cyclones in the future, which our climate change scientists suggest is going to occur, then the impacts will be greater and so on. So a lot of those factors are really playing out in Asia. The final point I make about Asia is that it is the most urbanized part of the world. And most of the mega cities in Asia, but most of you have all traveled through the region, been to Bangkok and Manila and Shanghai, they're all threatened by sea level rise to varying degrees. Jakarta, just about every city, Mumbai, Singapore. So sea level rise is a really big problem. It's not only that it's going to force lots of people to relocate from city areas, but it affects agricultural land. A lot of the fertile agricultural land is on the coast. So you get saline intrusions from the salt water. So you can't actually use the agricultural land either. So there are multiple effects, and they're all going to play out in this part of the world. So I think that Asia, this part, our region is going to be heavily impacted by all these changes.
And if I could just add to that, a recent U.S. Pacific commander, Admiral Locklear, when questioned about what are the biggest threats that he sees in the Asia-Pacific region, said that climate change is actually the most significant threat, even more so than terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. He took a lot of heat in some quarters of the U.S. political system for that comment, but he stood his ground nonetheless, and I think he sees exactly what Alan just described. It's the massive concentration, the urbanized cities that are very vulnerable. And should they become destabilized through an extreme weather event, sea level rise, combined with other factors in those countries, that could be a tipping point to further instability.
And could I just add one other point here that, I've had a lot of disagreements with colleagues who are skeptics about climate change, and my argument to them has been, it's fine to be skeptical if you are about the science, but I look at it from a hard-nosed risk point of view. It's a risk prism that I apply to this. So, as Sherry pointed out before, and it's in the film, when you look at the risk spectrum, at the lower end, you're talking about essentially low-level crime, sort of disturbances. Right up the high end of risk of the risk spectrum, was always nuclear war, because this is the thing that wipe us all out, right? So when I first started thinking about climate change, I thought, where would I place that on that threat spectrum? And the two key factors are probability and impact. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought climate change needs to be right up the high end of the spectrum, because it's actually more likely to occur, unfortunately, and hopefully, than nuclear war. But the impact could be just as severe, because five times already the five great extinctions, paleontologically and climatologically on the Earth, we've had 40 to 80% of the species in the human planet wiped out by climate change. So that's the Armageddon scenario. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but when you look at it from a risk point of view, you have to think about it as a high probability, high impact event. So taking that approach, I used to argue to my defence colleagues, well, if you worry about a nuclear threat against Australia, what's the probability of that occurring, do you think? And they would give me figures like 1% or 2%. And I say, okay, so what do you think of the likelihood of major climate change impacts, such as the things we've just seen there? And I finally got them to concede that probably was at least as high as that, if not higher. So I think that's the way I look at it. You don't have to be, you know, a fully paid up environmentalist, if you like, to, it's whether or not you believe in the science, it's just a risk kind of proposition. That's the way I think about it.
Let me bring you a little bit closer to Australia to focus on our near neighbours in the Pacific. The film mentioned that Bangladesh is ground zero of climate change. And I think, you know, our neighbours in Kiribati, for example, would put themselves in a similar category. There are a lot of Pacific countries who are taking mitigation strategies very seriously and are even buying up land in neighbouring countries, you know, to guard against the you know, eventual likelihood, sadly, that their countries will be largely underwater. What kind of security threat does that pose for Australia to have that kind of displacement in our near neighbourhood?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily think about it as a security threat. I think about it in terms of our obligations, foreign policy obligations, humanitarian obligations, to actually look after these people if they no longer have a place to live. Now, I've actually looked at this, and if you look at the small Pacific Island countries, it's reasonable to assume that over the next 50 to 100 years, many of them will become uninhabitable. So their people have to go somewhere. Now, some of them will go to New Zealand, some will go to the United States because of pre-existing relationships, and probably a handful of them have nowhere else to go, and we will be under enormous pressure to take them. These are things that are not that far down the track, to be frank. And just to illustrate the point, when we have the regular meetings, Pacific Island Forum meetings, where we meet, where Australian Prime Minister goes to meet Pacific Island leaders, at the top of the agenda is now consistently climate change. They see that as the number one security problem for them, broadly defined. It's a survival issue for them. So we will, in my view, is we do have some obligation to think about how we can help. That may include taking numbers of them. And this illustrates the broader point about climate change refugees. Now, if I can just add one point on this, I don't want to be accused of beating this up. So there have been figures bandied around that I've had a look at, which seem to be a little bit large, but 150 million people is one figure that's been put on the number of climate change refugees we're likely to experience in this region. So when I went and had a look at the actual data sets on this, and I sort of looked at it, I thought it is actually plausible, because you're talking about maybe 20 million people, 15 million people in Bangladesh with a 1 meter sea level rise. Now, most scientists will tell you that the expectation is you'll get about 1 meter of sea level rise by the end of this century. So there's 20 million. If you look at Shanghai, which the Chinese government already accepts, probably parts of that city will have to be relocated. And you add up the figures, you come to something close to 150 million. It's not that hard to get to. It's a big number. So just think about that alone, how that's going to impact, just in terms of instability, the human and financial costs of managing that. And that's thrown in the mix of a whole lot of other challenges, security challenges and other challenges. That's the problem with climate change. It's just it is that threat multiplier, as we've been talking about. And Jared Diamond made this point in his very famous book, about why, how civilizations rise and fall. And he said, often what happens is countries and societies get to a tipping point where they're at the limits of the resources to sustain it. And then you get climate change that tips them over. And that is quite conceivable that that could happen in our part of the world.
Ian, I want to come to you, because you know better than most that the Australian debate on climate change is really lagging. Political turnover has contributed to a lack of long-term policy making, and both sides have really struggled to define their environmental stance. And we've arrived at the odd spectacle of some Australian businesses actually asking to be taxed on carbon emissions, looking for certainty. Lowy Institute polling shows that the number of Australians who say global warming is a serious and pressing problem and we should begin taking steps now, even if this involves significant costs, has risen steadily from a low of 36% in 2012 to 53% last year. So an increase of 17 points over 3 years, but it remains 15 points lower than the high point of concern in 2006 when it was recorded at 68% of people agreeing with that statement. Do you think that understanding climate change as a security issue can reframe the debate here? I'm talking both in a political sense and amongst the general population.
Well, I certainly hope so, because the debate in this country has gone backwards at a rate of knots over the last decade. We had far more progressive attitudes, I think, in the late 1990s. After Kyoto was signed, we ratified it finally, but when it was signed, I think there was a lot of genuine, serious interest in, okay, how do we fix this? Obviously, it's going to be an increasing problem. Now, in the intervening period, really, this has become probably the most politicized issue in the country. I don't think either major political party really accepts that climate change is actually happening. I think we're really in the point where there is almost total denial amongst large parts of the political community, particularly on the more conservative side, certainly. But even, say, amongst the ALP, I don't think the real understanding is accepted. Now, the problems we're now having in energy security, in my view, just stem directly from the fact that we've had 20 years of procrastination where nobody's been prepared to really accept that climate change was going to become the dominant issue in deciding the policy positions we took right across the board, particularly on energy. But it's going to affect really everything we do. I mean, migration obviously is a major issue. You're not going to handle the sort of numbers that Alan's talking about with stop the boats in the way that we've basically seen it. The problem is much bigger than that. I mean, the film basically looks, it took as its starting point, as Sherry said, the original set of reports a decade ago. And it then looked what has actually happened in the intervening decade. Now, if you listen to the science, the latest information coming through, the concern has always been that we were sooner or later going to reach these scientific tipping points where the climate flipped from one relatively stable state to another, which was far less conducive to human development. And that's always been the big worry, that it won't just gradually increase over time, but you get this sudden change because of positive feedback loops in the system. Now, what we're starting to see is that we are now hitting some of those tipping points. If you look at the Arctic, the speed at which sea ice has been disappearing. If you look at the Antarctic, you're seeing the same sort of thing happening with the breakup of ice sheets for slightly different reasons. If you look at the Amazon rainforest, one of the biggest carbon sinks in the world, it now for several years at a time becomes a carbon source. So we're getting to the point where very big changes are starting to get locked in. Now, I think there's been the assumption in our system that this is just one other item on the political agenda, and it can be diced and compromised like all the others. I think what is missing is that the acceptance that this is actually totally different from anything we've ever faced before. As Alan said, this is a risk management exercise. but it's not risk management in the way that financial markets or the corporate sector is accustomed to dealing with it. This is an existential risk. It's one that if we don't get it right, humanity basically will not survive. And that applies as much to us as it does to anybody else on the globe. Now, we are at the point where we have to have a serious discussion about the fact that that's the position we're in. The Paris Agreement is aimed at stopping temperatures rising above 2 degrees C and trying to keep them well below that and ideally aiming for 1.5 degrees C. Now, that was signed in December 2015. Subsequently, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has been asked to come up with a view about how do you actually achieve that? How are we going to stay below 2 degrees C? And that paper, I think, is due out next year sometime. But in the meantime, we're now seeing a spate of papers emerging where scientists, very top-level scientists, are saying, well, how are we going to do it? And these are the solutions we really have to start adopting. And what they're focusing on is where we have to start seeing emissions reduce by something like 9 or 10% a year from virtually today onwards. We have to make a whole range of other changes and technological improvements to start being able to sequester carbon and draw it down from the atmosphere with technologies that, quite frankly, don't exist today. And that has to start to be applied within the next 20 years. And have the ability to make a major impact. Now, we're nowhere near that. And yet in this country, we're talking about continuing to build a large number of coal mines, obviously the Adani mine in Queensland, but a whole host of others, at a point when what the scientists tell us is that the carbon budget, that's the budget, the amount of fossil fuel emissions we can continue to put into the atmosphere, in theory, there's a bit more left. To have a 50-50 chance of staying below 2 degrees C. But the reality is that if you're an engineer, as I am, I mean, you don't put up a building or put up a bridge with a 50-50 chance of it falling down. I mean, you wouldn't get on a plane to go from here to Melbourne with a 50-50 chance of getting that. And that's what we're playing around with the climate. I mean, we can't repeat this game. One of the big problems that isn't really understood is the lag effect in the climate. So whatever we do today gets locked in for decades ahead, and you can't reverse that. Now, our political system, our corporate world, really has to get to the point of recognizing that that's now the position we're in. We have to start to have a serious discussion on the size of the problem, which is quite different from anything that's being talked about. And it comes down to a point that was made in response to the Queen. In 2008, she was at the London School of Economics, and she asked, well, why is it that nobody actually anticipated the timing and the size of the global financial crisis? And it took, I think it was the British Academy, about a year to answer. And she said, and they said, look, a psychology of denial existed throughout the financial and corporate worlds, a failure of the imagination to really understand the risks to the system as a whole. And that's exactly the point I think we have in this country with climate change at the moment, is that we're not accepting the level of risk. We have to recognize also that all of the arguments that we were hearing are about slowing down the change. It's not about trying to grasp the problem and fix it. It's about how do we keep our coal and keep our gas and keep all those things working until we get to the point where maybe sooner or later we'll have to do something. Now, we can't do that. Around the world, people are moving far, far faster. In a geopolitical sense, we have another problem, and that is that we probably have the best renewable energy resources of anybody in the world, and we're not using them. We're proposing to build the world's biggest coal mine. Now, in geopolitical terms, selling that to the rest of the world as climate change really starts to bite is not going to be terribly easy. We have an opportunity. We have the biggest probably investment opportunity the world has ever seen. And we also have chances, I think, to not just solve our domestic problem, but to really see this as development of a whole export industry in the energy arena and a lot more besides, actually. So I think we really have this disconnect has got to be fixed. We need to have, obviously, bipartisan support to seriously talking about the problem. And I think we need leadership from the corporate world that, frankly, we're not seeing. I mean, most of the corporate world has not seriously been prepared to face up to the problem. There is lip service being paid. And there is certainly some companies are moving ahead, there's no question. But across the board, it's not happening to the extent we need.
Well, Sherry, if we have a problem of political will in Australia, then we certainly are seeing a similar problem since last November in the States. Mr. Trump, of course, described global warming as a hoax created by and for the Chinese in order to make US manufacturing non-competitive. During the campaign, he pledged to pull out of the Paris Agreement within his first 100 days in office, perhaps not realizing how difficult that would be from an international law perspective. But Politico reported last week that a supervisor at the Energy Department's International Climate Office told staff not to use the phrases climate change, emissions reduction, or Paris Agreement in written memos, briefings, or other written communication, although a DOE spokesperson has later denied that such a directive was given. So how do you see US climate policy playing out over the next 4 years? But in particular, where do you see the green shoots of hope?
Well, if it's a Chinese hoax, they're very successful because they're now walking right in to fill the vacuum left by the absence of U.S. global climate leadership. That is very true. They get it. The Chinese do very sophisticated, long-term economic and strategic planning. They understand where they need to get the resources to feed a hungry nation, to provide the resource, the mineral, energy, food and water resources they will need. And if that's pretending to be a climate leader, they'll take that up because it fits in their own national interest. Now, in actual fact, despite the fact that the Trump administration said it's going to, it has reversed a number of executive orders from the last administration, a number of CEOs of major global companies, including GE, Google, Apple, and others, have said they want to stay in the Paris Agreement, and it's in their interest and America's interest to continue to do so. And in fact, former Mayor Bloomberg, wrote just a few days ago, and which I agree that, you know, despite that, the U.S. is on track to meet its Paris commitments, partly because in the United States, coal is no longer a viable new energy source. Yes, we still have coal, but we get increasingly less of our electricity from coal. It's down from a third of our electricity to now a quarter, and vastly more jobs are being created in the renewable energy industry, wind and solar, than they are in the coal industry. And that trend is most likely to continue because, like Australia, the U.S. is also a renewable energy superpower. We have vast wind, solar resources. Also, like this country, there's a great innovation potential. You know, we need not only new sources, but we need new ways of transmitting energy. We have to free ourselves, as General Mattis said, from the tether of fuel when we're deploying our forces to combat. In Iraq and Afghanistan, 8 out of 10 convoys were for fuel and water and ammunition. They weren't about combat. They were about the logistics tail dragging down the fighting tooth of the military. That's unacceptable. For the last decade, the military, U.S. military, has been looking for ways to innovate and in energy and water for forces deployed to the front. So they are now using solar chargers for batteries for troops at the front and new ways of providing water so that we don't have to truck fuel and water to the front. And I think that type of innovation is also needed in the civilian sectors of society and is also beginning to occur. And that's the great sort of opportunity here, is the energy and resilience opportunity to create a better world, one we would like our children to inhabit, one that would leave the world a better place and that create that opportunity. And I think we have that. We've seen that innovation, enable us to move beyond, you know, beyond the horse-drawn age, to see beyond that, you know, as you said, you know, it's the, when Ford, you said earlier, Ford was, you know, asked his people and they just said, build a faster buggy, right? But, you know, we've seen now, we've lived in the automobile, the oil age for over a century now. But we see new ways to power transport. We can see new ways of providing, electricity and energy to people. And we need to really continue to seize that opportunity so that we're leading, that economic and into that sustainable future.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's a good moment, I think, to open up for questions. Please wait for the microphones. We have at least one, possibly two, circulating around. Tell us your name, your affiliation, if you have one, and please keep your question relatively brief. Andrea has the microphone, if you could raise your hand.
Paul Italiano, Chief Executive of Transgrid, New South Wales, an electricity company, of course. So thank you very much for the presentation tonight. My question to you, Ian, is, in the model that you described about taking action immediately, which I fully support, we get confronted with economists and regulatory frameworks that are concerned about the redistribution of wealth in society and the impact on investors and global capital markets. With your background, how do you propose to deal with that?
Well, I think the investor-corporate linkage or interface is probably the point of greatest leverage in the climate debate right now. If you go back, I mentioned, I think, when I was talking about the fact that we've become far less progressive on these issues in the last decade than we used to be. In my view, one of the main reasons for that is the way we pay people. Remuneration in terms of bonus payments, pay for performance, came in this country, what, in the mid-90s, or more or less. In the US, it existed long before. I think what isn't often talked about is that that change has fundamentally altered the whole attitude of business and basically, I think, the ethics of business, frankly, in that everybody has moved pretty much from being prepared to think about longer-term issues as well as the short-term to focusing very much on the short-term. So, I mean, anything that's much above 2 years doesn't get much of a look in any longer. Now, if you look at the way that our system, our economic system has moved, we've ended up with that type of attitude spreading right through the framework. Whether you look at business, politics, you look at sport, the same sort of thing. I mean, that short-termism now dominates the system, which means that anything that needs serious attention, 10, 20, 30 years ahead, just doesn't get the attention it used to. So I think that's been a major sort of ethical change. The big change I see happening is that the investment community is now starting to realize that the risks they're facing from climate change are real and they're now pretty much immediate. So you're seeing groups like the G20's Financial Stability Board, Climate Change Task Force on Climate Risk Disclosure, which was triggered by the Bank of England, Mark Carney and the Bank of England, is now coming out with reports saying we now need a much greater understanding of where climate risk exists in the world's stock markets. Otherwise, we're potentially facing a bigger potential risk and disaster than we had, or crisis than we had in 2008. Now, in addition to that, you're seeing increasing attention being paid to directors' duties, and the responsibility of directors to look at the fiduciary responsibility to address climate risk. And I think people are starting to realize that they are now personally liable if they don't start to focus in on these things. But I think the bigger problem in a cultural sense in Australia is the fact that, you used to have statesmen who stood up and were prepared to take a longer-term view, which wasn't just about their immediate short-term interest. I think we've basically got rid of those people in the last 10, 15 years. They don't exist any longer, which is a great pity. And I think is one reason for our present problems is that we don't have a corporate sector that is prepared to actually get out publicly and start talking about it. We need those people to come back.
Hello, I'm Tom Rari. I'm a member of the ALP and I study at Sydney University. I was just wondering, would it be fair to say that Tony Abbott's scrapping of the carbon tax was actually a catastrophic mistake for Australia's long-term climate and energy policy, and it's contributing to why we have so many energy problems now?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, we've lost 20 years with all of this machination going on. We've had carbon pricing finally got up after many, many years of arm wrestling. And we had it for, what, 2 years or maybe less, and it disappeared. I mean, the model that was there was not particularly good. It was a compromise, a major compromise on the work that was done in the 1990s. But nonetheless, it was a start. And I think, yes, it has set us back, undoubtedly. And not just getting rid of the carbon tax, but the fact that everybody was then scared, running scared from even raising the notion of pricing carbon, and that's still an issue. So, I mean, all of that has been extremely detrimental to the Australian economy, and it's cost this community billions, which is what you're now seeing with the, you know, the escalation of disaster, costs of disasters, and things like Cyclone Debbie, which you can't pin down to climate change exclusively. Nobody's saying you can, but the fact is that the intensity of cyclones is increasing. The scientific work will be done, and we will probably find that there is a major causation link in there, as we can now prove with previous events. So we're being left in a very dangerous position, that we're totally unprepared for the increasing severity of the economic costs of what's now hitting us.
Thank you. And Andrew Caldor. My question is to the panel about Indonesia. It's a relatively unstable country to our north, very densely populated. What are the consequences that are foreseeable there for Australia from a security point of view of climate change?
That's a good question. I think that the way I'd answer it is to say, first of all, make the point that what I'm about to say about Indonesia equally applies to a lot of other countries in the region too, but Indonesia is particularly important for us, so I take your point. So the issues I see are that you have a country of 250 million people which is struggling as a developing country with all the problems that developing countries have, and I think that climate risks are going to impact quite severely on Indonesia. One, because natural disasters are already, having quite a detrimental effect on Indonesia. We had the tsunami there, a decade or so ago. So there'll be situations where Australia will be looking to help Indonesia respond to natural disasters that are happening more frequently, where the Indonesians don't have at the moment the capability to deal with themselves. So there's a whole series of situations, climate-driven sort of crises, if you like, or impacts, where Australia will be, well, Indonesia will expect Australian assistance. That's the one set of issues around that. Then there's the problem about internal stability of Indonesia, which is something that all strategists in this country worry about continuously. And we used to worry, and I think in an exaggerated way, about being, threatened by Indonesia militarily, but I've never considered that to be very likely. I think the more problem, the bigger security problem we confront is a destabilized Indonesia from a multiplicity of threats, of which climate change is one. So there already is a terrorism issue there. There are already a lot of ethno-nationalist conflicts that have taken place over Indonesia in the last, over its history. They have their economic fault lines. There's all sorts of issues there. You throw climate change in the mix, it just gets a bit more difficult. Final point about Indonesia is the broader point that I made about capability and dealing with the consequences. Now, for richer countries like Australia, we are better placed to be able to manage these things. It's not easy for us either, but look at, again, go back to the Cyclone Debbie. If you just look at that, you think about the resources we've poured into that to help manage that. The Australian Defence Force has been deployed up there. They're actually quite good at doing this. They do this all the time now. It's part of their core business. You've got the special, you have various emergency services and people helping out. So we've got a range of structures around responses to these things that Indonesia just doesn't have it, along with a lot of other countries. So when something happens there, it has a longer lasting impact, and it can actually start to create the conditions that this film brings out, where you get large numbers of unemployed, disenfranchised people already there, where the climate change starts to actually create real problems with these people, internal displacements within Indonesia, forcing people to move, all those kinds of issues that the film's touched upon all actually apply to Indonesia. So I think there are a lot of issues around climate change. Final point is that, and this is about how Indonesians think about climate change, they tend not to really grapple with the longer-term strategic implications. They've got so many short-term problems they've got to deal with, the here-and-now things. But even at the governance level and the national security community, they're now starting to think more seriously about this because they've got a massive problem now in Jakarta, for example, where the water table is dropping dramatically and you're getting a lot of salinization sort of impacting detrimentally on the water supply. So they realise that climate change is starting to exacerbate a problem they've already got with declining freshwater availability. Seems strange for a country you think about as raining all the time, Indonesia, but they have major problems with fresh water. So all those things, again, that were brought out in that film do apply in Indonesia particularly.
They also have major tropical forests, which, like Brazil, have been deforested at a very rapid rate for the timber. That creates other global problems because forests are a carbon sink, but they are a source of income in Indonesian society.
Yeah, I think most of Indonesia's rainforests will have disappeared within 20 to 30 years. It's massive deforestation. So it used to be one of the great carbon sinks. You know, there's rainforests all through Kalimantan, most of Sumatra. A lot of that's gone now. I think 20 or 30 years of virtually be no rainforest left.
We have time for one more quick question, and I saw this hand up first.
If the IPCC's mid-range estimate is around 2.7 degrees of warming by the end of the century, we're all familiar with the moral arguments around solar radiation management, but I'm wondering if any of you have thoughts on the likelihood of solar radiation management being implemented and what path that might happen through.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a range of temperatures. The IPCC talks of 2.7. I think the probably more realistic figure is probably up around 3, 3.5. But whichever way you look at it, if you take the latest science, we're going to have to make massive changes if we seriously want to stay below 2 degrees C. The plus point is that there is an enormous number of things happening at the moment in terms of innovation, and the speed of innovation will probably surprise us, which, you know, we all hope it does, of course, and we need to get every effort into that. But the fact is that the market economy is not going to solve this on its own. There's going to have to be a lot of other regulatory changes if we decide we have to now get in and fix the problem. In terms of solar radiation management, I mean, it's getting talked about more and more seriously, obviously. This is basically geoengineering to keep temperatures down, it's, I think you're referring to. It's really the last resort because we don't know the implications of actually doing it. There are various approaches being mooted. I mean, one is putting, obviously, you know, sulfates into the atmosphere. In much the same way that coal aerosols actually keep temperatures lower than they might otherwise be. But it's a completely untried experiment. Now, I think you really have to use everything else you possibly can to avoid going in that direction. But nonetheless, the fact that we've procrastinated and left things for so long may mean we have to resort to those sort of methods. In terms of how do you do it, obviously, there's a massive set of legal issues, which I don't think the service has really been scratched at all on those at this point in time. As to what happens, you know, if one country does it, there's another country, and who's what the outcomes might be, and who's then responsible. But in a sense, you could argue that, I mean, what's gone in China since 2000? I mean, Chinese coal consumption doubled from 2 billion to 4 billion in 12 years, between 2000 and 2012. Now, that by itself may well have meant that we will see temperature go over 2 degrees C because we have no carbon budget left today. getting rid of those aerosols is going to, in fact, if we were to move to sort of gas of some form or increased use of gas or sort of radiation issues, there is going to be a one-off jump in temperature because of the removal of coal aerosols from the atmosphere. So there's a whole lot of interacting issues which are extremely difficult to combine, which is why we need, I mean, I think in the end, climate change really has to become the reason for far greater global cooperation than we've ever seen before. I mean, we're either going to go in the direction of the film where we have increasing conflict, or we're going to get to the point where the world recognizes it's in everybody's interest to try and fix this. And we then start to put together global responses that genuinely do look at this as an emergency, which has to be handled at sort of emergency speed. So I think the solar radiation management issue is part of that package. I don't think anybody's really got the solutions to exactly how it's going to unfold at this point in time, but that getting to that cooperation point is going to be critical if it's ever going to be used on it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Thank you for asking such thoughtful questions. We have a busy events program in the coming days and a few tickets still available. Tomorrow at lunchtime, we have the Sydney launch of our new Lowy Institute paper by Bobo Low, A Wary Embrace, What the China-Russia Relationship Means for the World. And in the evening, we have a panel that will debate the proposition, Why Citizens Should Win the Battle for Sovereign Wealth Funds. I hope to see you there. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the panel.